Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Voice Lessons, How a Couple of Ninja Turtles, Pinky, and an Animaniac Saved My Life, by Rob Paulson with Michael Fleeman. Narrated by Rob Paulson. This book is dedicated to the human spirit. Now, it sounds a bit pretentious for a cartoon voice guy's story, but the examples of utter courage in the everyday heroes cited herein have been and continue to be a source of inspiration, kindness, hope, and faith for me. Family, friends, and fans. We all fit those categories, and we truly are all in this together, kids. So if my story inspires positive action, elicits joy, gives the reader strength, well, that, I believe, is what we're all here to do for each other. Narf. Thank you, Perry, Ash, Pushy, and Taylor, for making me a lottery winner. Heart. Laughter's the best medicine. The cool thing is you can't OD, and the refills are free.
Forward. If a couple of Ninja Turtles, Pinky, and an Animaniac saved my dad's life, then it's fair to say mine has been heavily informed by the experience of growing up amid these and other colorful, unique characters. I was surprised and a little confused at first when my dad asked me to write the foreword for this book. Why not any number of the other world-class voice actors who were at once mutually talented colleagues and lifelong friends, I wondered. I've been around for most of his voice acting career, of course, but other than a really exciting video game role he landed in the early aughts, whereas my dad has made his home and livelihood in the animation world, mine is firmly entrenched in the console gaming space. I've rarely found myself in the position of informing it. That role was Gray Fox in Metal Gear Solid The Twin Snakes, if you're wondering. But I soon realized that was exactly why. None of his colleagues have the unique perspective, at least as far as I'm aware, of knowing what it's like to grow up as the son of a world-class voice actor who has brought to oral life some of the most beloved, celebrated cartoon characters of all time. As you might imagine, that kind of career success, life fulfillment, and general notoriety can cast a large, looming shadow for a kid and, later, teenager and young adult trying to find their own place in the world. But I would later realize, from a more adult perspective, that the whole gamut of experiences I had growing up amid my dad's work, especially the many positively great ones like the nationwide trips for Warner Brothers Studio Store appearances I accompanied him for, or counting legends like Mark Hamill among the invitees to one of my birthday parties, were all fully contextualized by my dad's successes, not his failures. Much like how people today filter their lives on social media, I only ever saw the good aspects of his career, never the bad. It wasn't until later on, as an adult having adult conversations with my dad, that I would be exposed to the other side of any successful career, his struggles, his disappointments, his failures. As Thanos said, perfectly balanced, as all things should be. Fortunately, dear Rob Paulson fan, which I imagine you must be if you're listening to this book, you don't have to wait that long to learn about the full spectrum of my dad's career, and you don't even have to be related to him. The good and the bad, the moments on top of the world and at rock bottom, it's all here, set against the backdrop of the many and wide-ranging voice lessons he has learned throughout his career. Many, if not most, tough and not so fun to learn. But more importantly than a blow-by-blow account of my dad's life and career, and I do mean blow-by-blow, like this thing is astonishingly detailed, you'll learn what it means to leverage your own voice lessons in service of the voiceless, those whose lives have been beset by tragedy many of us can't even fathom, and those for whom meeting the voice behind a couple of Ninja Turtles, Pinky, and an Animaniac may well be one of the most important, exciting moments of their lives. That's the one thing I hope you take away from this book, other than the kind of granular knowledge about my dad that would be right at home on a Trivial Pursuit card. Inspired by the utmost respect and humility with which my dad has always approached and treated his fans, I in turn have been fortunate enough in my adult life to have had the opportunity to carve out my own relatively public platform, which I have been able to use in service of bringing that same kind of goodness and humility to the fans I am fortunate enough to have in the gaming space. Not everyone is lucky or privileged enough to have the chance to genuinely affect others' lives for the better, and too many of us who are simply don't, choosing instead to focus on the power and leverage their fame affords them over others. Over the course of reading voice lessons, I learned a lot of stuff about my dad's life and career that I never knew, and rest assured you will learn even more. And you, as a Rob Paulson fan, will undoubtedly soak up every word of that stuff. But that's not what this book is really about. The real story, the real takeaways, are between the front-facing factoids about my dad's time on this planet. They are, in fact, found within the voice lessons we can all apply in our own lives to make the world a little better than it is today. Ash Paulson.
Introduction. Pinky gets bad news. Pinky, I gotta tell you, dude, I got some bad news.
Is it really bad, Rob?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Maybe you can guess what it is?
Oh, no. Wait a minute. Rosie O'Donnell is back on network TV?
No.
I'm soaking in it?
No.
Oh, you got me all freaked out, Rob. You've got me all... Oh,
no. Whoa. Take a breath.
Okay.
Let's put it this way. I'm a Pisces, not a Cancer, although it seems I have it.
You what? You have cancer? Are you going to die?
Well, I suppose I could. I don't really know yet.
Well, who's going to pay for this car?
You don't drive.
Yeah, but you do, you idiot. And they call me the dumb one. Don't you die on me. I need food pellets and maybe even a reboot someday.
I can talk to Pinky all day. I have a comfortable enough knowledge of the way he pronounces words, the phrases he would use, the way he interacts with other characters and human beings, that my brain shuts down and Pinky takes over. Rob checks out, and Pinky checks in. I was lucky enough to help create him. I made a choice to have him struggle pronouncing R's because of his buck teeth. I threw in a goofy kind of Cockney thing because Peter Sellers and Monty Python's Flying Circus were huge inspirations to me as a kid. I say help create because there's so much more to Pinky. I often tell people I don't draw him and I don't write him. And I don't animate him. I'm just the actor. I'm only as good as the concept and the writing and the direction, among many other factors. It takes an army of talented people and a series of happy and sometimes painful accidents to bring a character to life. If you're really lucky and lightning strikes, you end up with a character who doesn't just live, but who becomes iconic. In my case, I've been very lucky. Of the 1,000 or so characters I've voiced in more than 30 years of animation, I've been fortunate to boast of at least 5 that have occupied prominent places in pop culture.
Pinky and Yakko
from Animaniacs.
Cowweezer
from Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius. And 2 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Raphael from the original show. And
Donatello
from a later version. These characters have given me endless joy. I don't just voice them for money. No matter where I am, the store, the airport, even the cancer ward, it takes little prompting for me to whip them out. Then I watch as the joy I feel spreads. Children and adults, cops and nurses and soldiers and salespeople and lawyers, they can't help but smile and laugh. Cartoon characters bring them back to a place of innocence and pure, unadulterated happiness. They're back in their living rooms, home from school, homework stuffed in their backpacks, maybe something cooking in the kitchen, and the TV tuned to their favorite shows. And maybe now they have kids of their own, sharing a few minutes in front of the television, or more likely the computer or iPad, revisiting those wonderful cartoons, returning to a place so gentle and sweet, now laughing at the subversive jokes and sight gags they didn't get when they were kids. There are a lot of reasons I wanted to write this book. One is I hope that people would learn a little more about the actors behind those voices. For generations, they brought nothing but happiness to the world, yet they worked in relative obscurity, performing their magic anonymously, behind the microphone in recording studios and nondescript buildings in Burbank and Studio City. The people who primarily work with their voices are among the most gifted, unpretentious, fearless actors I've ever known. Thanks to social media and the popularity of conventions like Comic-Con, we are finally more recognizable than we used to be. I would love for this book to shine an even brighter light on them. I also want to show, in my little way, the hidden power of these cartoon characters. They make us giggle, of course, but it goes deeper. I've been fortunate enough to get to know countless children with serious health problems, many of them life-threatening. Brave kids like my buddy Chad, whom you'll meet later in this book. I talk to them in cartoon voices, sign posters, share a laugh and a hug, and often, with their parents, tears. I always marvel at how much a few words from a turtle can mean to a kid enduring circumstances none of us can imagine. These moments so inspired me that I had considered writing this book years ago. Then one day, a little lump on my neck appeared. Without a brutal assault of radiation and chemicals, that lump would kill me, the doctor said. I was fortunate enough to live in an era in which modern science could cure me. Now, by cure, I mean get rid of the lump. But would I be the same again? The doctors minced no words. They could cure me, but they couldn't guarantee that my voice would survive. I'd be able to speak, they said. But make a living as a voice actor? Their job, they said, was to save me, not my career. And so I found myself at home one day, lying in front of the TV, watching something on DVD, zonked on Vicodin or medicinal marijuana, my throat on fire, my stomach resistant to food and even water, dry heaving, maniacally hiccuping, wasting away. I looked in the mirror. A skeleton looked back with glassy eyes. I'd become one of those sick kids I used to visit. I didn't feel sorry for myself. I didn't feel betrayed by my body. I didn't say, why me? In fact, I usually said, why not me? I'd had a marvelous life, lived every dream I had as a kid in Grand Blanc, Michigan. I was 60 years old. If I never worked another day in Hollywood again, well, so be it. In fact, if I were in corporate America, I might have been downsized by now anyway. My story, I believe, is pretty small potatoes in terms of an actual physical struggle. But I learned a few lessons along the way that I hope will help others. Lessons about faith and love and empathy, about growing older in an industry that craves youth, about what it means to almost lose everything you hold dear, only to discover those things that are the most important. It's a story about how silence helped me speak louder than ever. And it's about
Pinky and Yakko
and Carl
and Raphael
and Donatello
and all those little critters banging around inside my head. It's about unleashing the power of humor and cartoons. It's about turtle power, which I'm proud to say is very real. Chapter 1. A Kick in the Reboot. So three cartoon characters and a musician walk into a restaurant. Morton's, the steakhouse in Burbank, is down the street from the Warner Brothers lot where Yakko, Wacko, and Dot Warner made their home in the water tower. A big dinner was set for this night, an honest-to-goodness Hollywood power meal, hosted by the Big Cheese at Warner Brothers for the benefit of three cartoon characters and a musician. Myself, Jess Harnell, Tress MacNeille, and Randy Rogel, respectively,
Yakko, Wacko, Dot,
and the primary songwriter from Animaniacs. It was March of 2016, and naturally, we were the noisiest table in the joint, a gaggle of artists with stunted emotional growth and little impulse control who make their living amusing your children when you're not looking, and sometimes when you are. Morton's is one of those restaurants that has movie star pictures all over the walls. Bob Hope watched over us as we waited for Sam Register, the head of animation. We were chittering and chattering and making silly sounds. We gossiped and talked shop and caught up with each other. We've known each other for years, and we somehow all managed to keep working and, more importantly, remain the best and biggest of friends in this crazy competitive business. I put actor on my tax form. I don't necessarily delineate voice actor unless somebody says, "Have you ever done any real acting?" Well, I guest starred as a junior G-man on MacGyver, played a husband on New Love American Style, brought a friend into St. Elsewhere, and traveled through time in Amazing Stories. In the movies, I played a porno film director and a gay flight attendant. In commercials, I sold soft drinks, blue jeans, fried chicken, milk, and Hondas. And if I still get a blank stare and a disappointed look, I give them a little Pinky or Yakko or Carl or a turtle. Then they know who I am. This night, I had been a cartoon voice actor since the mid-1980s when I baked up a Boston accent for a red-headed soldier named Snow Job for the first cartoon of G.I. Joe. That was back when Marvel was just making comic books and cartoons and not blockbusters starring Robert Downey Jr. in flying suits. I've done over 2,000 half-hours of animation and probably 1,100 commercials? My IMDb page stretches from here to Mars with cartoon credits, volume always being the key to my career success. This is just voice work specifically. I don't know how many video games features or direct-to-video things I've done. Animaniacs is the big one. It changed my life. It still changes my life. The most precious professional gift I've ever received. Now, there were rumblings it was coming back. Created by Tom Ruger and executive producer Steven Spielberg, the show ran for 6 seasons from 1993 to 1998, a delightful romp about 3 cartoon characters drawn originally back in the 1930s by the same folks at Warner Brothers Animation who came up with Looney Tunes. Wacko, Yakko, and Dot were deemed too irreverent, too difficult to handle, and thus got stashed in the water tower to keep them from getting into mischief. They were forgotten for decades until they ultimately escaped, and hilarity ensued. The show took the form of a variety program, a sort of animated Carol Burnett show. Yakko, Wacko, and Dot would sing and dance and star in comedy bits. They also introduced other segments, including some featuring another voice I do, a lab mouse named Pinky, who teamed with a fellow mouse, the Brain, in his schemes for world domination, which inevitably fell flat. Their sequences became so popular they got their own show, Pinky and the Brain. For 2 decades, fans had been asking if Animaniacs could ever come back on the air. It's one of the most common questions I'm asked on Twitter or at conventions. As Animaniacs survived and thrived in syndication and then on Netflix, the kids who watched it in the 90s started having their own kids, which we all figured explained this night's dinner. Reboot fever had been sweeping Hollywood and had spilled into animation. The reality was that none of us from the show had any better idea if the show was coming back than the average fan. We left Animaniacs with fond memories and fatter bank accounts and moved on to new voices. But there were clues. A little more than 2 years before the Morton's dinner, Randy and I had approached Warner Brothers about securing the music license for a live stage show featuring Animaniacs songs. One of the singular joys of Animaniacs was that it allowed me to not only talk in character, but to sing. The very first tune Randy Rogel wrote for the show was for my character, Yakko's World, a rat-a-tat recitation of country names to the tune of the Mexican Hat Dance. It immediately became an audience favorite, and has been one of the reasons people still come to see me at comic conventions and live shows all these years later. It's my stairway to heaven. We were working up a show with Randy at the piano and me at the microphone, both of us singing his amazingly clever and catchy songs, sometimes syncing the words to cartoon clips. We had a handshake deal on the rights. We wanted to make it all legal. For that, we needed permission from Warner Brothers and Mr. Spielberg. That's how, 15 years after the show went off the air, Randy and I found ourselves in an office on the studio lot one day, schmoozing with the suits. We were in one gentleman's office and had another muckety-muck on the line in New York. I was making the pitch, and things didn't seem to be going well. The guy in New York didn't seem to understand why I wanted to do this show with Randy. About 15 minutes into the conversation, the New York guy stopped in the middle of the meeting and said, "Wait a minute, Rob. Are you the guy who did the voices?" "Yeah," I said. "Oh, my God. Now it makes sense." With all the usual studio turnover, nobody knew who the hell we were. I looked at Randy, and we could read each other's thoughts. We're screwed. Warner Brothers kicked the idea around, and so, I'm presuming, did Mr. Spielberg and his people. And in the end, we got a great licensing deal. That allowed us to take the show all over the country. Sometimes Randy on the piano and me singing, sometimes accompanied by full symphony orchestras. Audiences love it, and we have the best time doing it. I began to suspect that one of the reasons Randy and I got the rights was because Warner Brothers and Mr. Spielberg were thinking of using our little performances as trial balloons to see if there was still a fan base for Animaniacs. It didn't escape our notice that at one of our bigger shows, the audience was sprinkled with Warner Brothers brass. And now, here we were at Morton's, and Sam Register was taking his seat. After exchanging hellos, Sam got down to it. Steven has been kicking around the idea of doing Animaniacs again. Sam spoke of his respect for us and respect for the fan base and how they didn't want to make any mistakes.
He very politely noted that we were getting a bit older and might be planning on retiring. He said that Steven, he calls him Steven, I'm more comfortable with Mr. Spielberg, had made it clear that it was going to be with us four, or he wouldn't do it at all. The bottom line is, Sam concluded, would you guys be interested? He barely got it out of his mouth when we all lost our respective shit. Metaphorically, of course, this was a high-class restaurant. That got a smile from Sam. I kind of figured you'd say that, he said. Trust me, the thought of it is very appealing to a lot of us. We were all, of course, completely flattered and thrilled at being buttered up and told how important the voice actors are to the studio and to the fans. You have to understand, voice actors don't usually get the star treatment. We're paid well, treated professionally, and to a person, we love our jobs with all our hearts. But let's face it, we're no Brad Pitts. No paparazzi wait outside Spago to get a shot of the guy who's a singing bacon strip on VeggieTales. This potential reboot was a big deal involving big bucks. We're not talking about some goofy little show or a weird video game and somebody with a bunch of money thinking, hey, let's try to make this into a cartoon and find that old guy who did Pinky. Oh, it's Ron Pullman or Rod whoever he is. We're talking about Animaniacs and Steven Spielberg, Warner Brothers, all of that. We asked Sam how soon this would happen. We're not sure, Sam said. We're on Steven time. He chuckled, and we knew what he meant. Steven Spielberg is the king of Hollywood. He'll do it when he does it. So we left the dinner very excited. In the parking lot, the four of us were glowing from flattery. Then my stomach sank. Could it be true? Could they really be getting the old gang back together? None of us was getting any younger. What a way to cap off a career. But it brought up conflicted emotions. The good news was the studio wanted to do this. The bad news was they wanted to do this. It was all for one and one for all, and I didn't know if I was going to be one of those ones. I didn't know if I'd have any voice left when they got around to making the show. Hell, I didn't know if I'd have any me left. Guys, I said to my friends, I haven't told Sam. I was shaving one day in early 2015 when I found the lump on the left side of my neck. It was about a half an inch long, under my skin, very hard to the touch. I knew enough about basic anatomy to guess this was in the area of a lymph node. I figured it was swollen because of a bacterial infection. It would go away. I didn't go to the doctor. For a 59-year-old, I felt like my health was great. I didn't smoke. I drank maybe twice a week, and then only a glass. I wasn't losing weight. I was playing golf 2 or 3 days a week. My prostate received regular visits by the doctor and cheerily responded with great PSA tests. I was working like crazy. But I was just concerned enough to do some home research. Into Google, I entered swollen glands and swollen bump on neck. Back came everything from low-grade infection to impending slow and painful death. The testimonials on the cancer message boards offered massive doses of TMI, but also enough case studies that I could pick and choose so that I could focus on the good stuff and ignore the bad. I could barely see the lump. I didn't tell any of my friends or work colleagues. I didn't tell my wife. One reason was I didn't want to worry her. The other reason was I didn't want her to say, honey, go get it looked at right now. I am, for better or worse, a hopeless optimist. A glass half full kind of guy. In this case, it was a little bit for the worse. I ignored the lump. My first voice lesson. My wife was right. I was an idiot. In February 2016, I had an appointment at my internist's office to get a blood test in preparation for my annual physical. I felt great. I bounded into his offices in the Century City Medical Towers. In the previous few years, I'd bounced back from the worst crisis of my professional life, one that had left me unemployed and put my marriage and sanity on the brink. We'll get to this later. And I was now busier than ever with both cartoon projects and my own endeavors. I was working on the 5th season of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as well as The Fairly Odd Parents for Nickelodeon. I was working on a show called Doc McStuffins for Disney TV, which would win another Peabody Award. I was doing live appearances. I had conventions booked throughout the year. My Talkin' Toons podcast was building an audience. Life was good, and I like good. I come from cartoons, remember, where there's nothing that can't be solved with a big wooden mallet and a crate of Acme dynamite. It's not that I'm irresponsible, per se. Had one of my sports cars made a weird noise, I would have taken that bad boy to the dealership immediately and hooked it up to every scope in the garage. Had it been my wife or my son or my best friend, I would have dropped everything and done anything to help. It's only when trouble looms for me personally that I tend to catch the first boat to Denial Isle and find that sunny spot until the clouds pass. So I wasn't particularly concerned that day when I took a seat in the waiting room. A couple of minutes later, my internist happened to walk by. I wasn't supposed to see him for another few days for the physical. I don't know what prompted me, but I blurted out, "Hey, Doc, hang on a second. Would you do me a favor and just put your hands on this?" I pointed to the lump. He said, "Come into the office." 5 seconds was all it took. 5 seconds for him to feel my neck and say, "Not good, Rob."
Yeah, I said. "Doc Paulson, Google MD.
No, seriously, this is not good. If it were an infection, it would be soft and pliable, like it was filled with fluid," he said. "This is a knot. And it is a lymph node, not a gland. You need to see an ear, nose, and throat guy like yesterday." I asked him what it could be. "I'm not going to tell you too much because you need to see an ENT and you got to get a biopsy," he said. "If it's bad news, it'll probably be quite treatable, but you need to get right on this." He arranged for an appointment with a specialist at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Beverly Hills, the hospital to the stars, and me. I maintained my usual positive Toontown attitude, happy as one of my cartoon alter egos. I called my wife, Parrish, from the car and said there was something I needed to talk about. "What?" she said, concerned. "Is it bad?" "Well, maybe," I said. "Is it Ashton?" she asked. "Ash is our son." "I have this lump," I said. I didn't want to tell you anything until I knew more, because it may be nothing. "But I'm going to go see a specialist in a couple of days, and I may be wearing a Band-Aid on my neck afterwards, so you're going to say, 'What the hell happened?'" She was not happy. Not for the first time. She reminded me I was an idiot. She usually says it with a big smile. "He's an idiot, but he's my idiot." My wife has to be understanding to be able to live with someone who does what I do for a living. Sometimes it has its advantages. She's from North Carolina, and one time when she went home to visit relatives, this was right around the time Ninja Turtles took off in the early 90s, she went to a drugstore in Shelby, North Carolina, to cash a check. But she forgot her ID, and the cashier wouldn't do it. The manager came out and recognized my name on the check. "Go ahead," he said. "Her husband's Raphael. Turtles are good for the money." On the other hand, I can't count how many times she's rolled her eyes at me. Typically, this happens when we're in public and I find myself falling into character, often loudly, often surrounded by people, usually at inappropriate times. As you'll see, it doesn't take much for me to launch into a character. An appreciative fan, sunlight. I'm a performer. I can't help it. Put the default setting on happy. It took me a few days to get in to see the ear, nose, and throat doctor, more because of my schedule than his. I had a couple of cartoon gigs, and I didn't want to turn down any work. The last thing I wanted to do was announce to Hollywood, "Hire me, but first I got to go see a guy about something growing on my neck." It's no newsflash that it's tough to grow old gracefully in Hollywood, even in voice acting, in which nobody knows what you look like. Ageism poses a real threat. I could see my career slipping back to the lonely, awful place I had just emerged from. Luckily, one of the first lessons you learn in the talking business is knowing when to shut up. In a week, I saw the Cedars doctor. His walls were covered in plaques and diplomas from prestigious universities, always a good sign. He asked me questions about my health. "All good," I told him. "Fit as can be. Voice in perfect shape. You want a turtle with martial arts skills? I can give you two of them." After the visual inspection, he put on a rubber glove and said, "You're going to hate this." I shuddered. "What end are you going for, pal?" "Just come here," he said. "I know I've had my head up my ass before," I said, "but if you've got to get to my throat that way, I'm in serious trouble." A lame joke, but I was getting nervous. Shtick is one of my coping mechanisms. A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your pants, and chase those worries away. He bent back my head. I opened my mouth, and he shoved his fingers down my throat. He spent 10 or 15 seconds poking around. He was down so deep, it felt like it was somewhere between my mouth and my lungs.
I had a world-class gag reflex. Fortunately, I didn't have any Hungarian goulash that came up.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?